Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Those are the voices of Rosemary Kuhlman and Chet Allen, the original Amal and Mother from Giancarlo Minotti's beloved Christmas opera, Amal and the Night Visitors. This work is among the most often performed of all operas and has had a very special place in our cultural landscape since its very first performance on Christmas Eve 1951 over NBC television. The first opera conceived specifically for television, but also an opera that has enjoyed a rich legacy on the sort of normal theatrical stages of the world. And it is about to be performed at the De Koven Center in the Great Hall. And I'm very excited to be able to speak in this portion of the morning show with Nick Berudian, who is artistic director of the Bell Ensemble. Nick has been on the program before to talk about all kinds of different and interesting programs that the Bell Ensemble has done. And now it is Amal and the Night Visitors, which they undertake in a very exciting project indeed. Nick will be conducting the performance. And Nick Berudian, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here, and it's always fun to talk about this marvelous opera, Amal and the Night Visitors. Your own personal connection to this opera, I know, goes back quite a few years. Explain to our listeners your first-hand initial introduction to Amal and the Night Visitors.
Of course. I must have been a junior in my undergraduate at Carthage College studying voice with you, and Jim Schatzman and the Choral Arts Society. I'm not sure they were called the Choral Arts Society at the time.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But anyway, either the Choral Arts Society or their predecessor group was putting on Amal and the Night Visitors and needed a page, and Greg Berg, one of the kings, happened to have a student who he thought might do the role. So I got to be the page and get a little taste of A Mall and the Night Visitors. And that's all you need, really, to get hooked.
Well, and I should think it's ideal, in a sense, to start out with a role that's important but very small in length. And so you mostly get to watch. And so you really got to take in this opera and all of its magic right from the start.
It was wonderful, yeah. And the page is, as you mentioned, has very few lines. They are crucial lines, and so it's sometimes a hard role to cast. But the page is also there for the entire show. Mm. He's right there at the side of the kings. So it really is. It was nice from that perspective to absorb the entire work, even with the little contribution that I had.
So tell our listeners whatever it is that you know about the creation of this opera, A Mall and the Night Visitors, and maybe sketch a little bit of the basic storyline.
Right. As you mentioned, this is the first made-for-TV opera. It was a commission from NBC to Giancarlo Menotti in 1951. Giancarlo Menotti had recently received a Pulitzer Prize for his opera, The Consul, and so was kind of coming into his own as a composer of Italian-American background, and received this commission, as he tells it, with a broadcast day of Christmas Eve, 1951, he was walking through the Metropolitan Museum of Art in November of that year without an idea yet of what to do for this opera. And he stopped before Hieronymus Bosch's painting, The Adoration of the Magi, in the Met, and all of a sudden was flooded with memories of his youth growing up in Italy, where it's not Santa Claus, but the three kings that, mm-hmm. that bring the gifts around Christmas time. And so all of his memories about gift giving and sort of the mythology around Christmas and the legends of the three kings, he channeled into this opera in the span of less than 2 months. I don't know, he doesn't tell exactly what day he sat down and started writing things, but what we know is that cast members were still receiving scores as they were in production, in rehearsal, and Samuel Barber had to be roped into coming in to quickly finish the orchestral score because it was that late in the process. The story of A Mall and the Night Visitors is sort of an interpolation of that biblical narrative about the three magi from the East that come to visit the Holy Family at the birth of Jesus. Amal and his mother live in some unknown location, but somewhere in the Near East, and they receive a knock on the door one night from, it turns out, these three kings. Now, Amal is lame in one of his legs and hobbles around as he's able to with a crutch under one arm, and his mother and he and his mother are essentially destitute, having given up the flock of sheep and goats that Amal used to care for. So the story, this 47-minute made-for-TV opera is essentially, you know, not much longer than that in the time that it represents on stage. There's a moment when everybody's asleep, but really it's just this hour of life, this hour in the life of poor Amal and his mother, and then the shenanigans that take place when they're visited by three royal figures wandering through the desert,
right,
needing a place to crash.
So in other words, this opera pretty much unfolds in real time. It is one continuous scene with no suspension of time. And it seems to me, too, that the fact that this was conceived for television, but for live television. I mean, it's not like it was recorded with a million different cameras and spliced together from this and that. I mean, when it was telecast on Christmas Eve, it was a live performance unfolding on a relatively simple, small soundstage, which also makes it really ideal for a group like the Bell Ensemble working with a relatively modest space. I mean, it's really interesting how something conceived for the one medium can work so very well for the other.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Nick Berutian about the Bell Ensemble's performance of Giancarlo Minotti's opera A Mall and the Night Visitors, which takes place tonight at the Great Hall of the De Koven Center. And it is a production that is going to feature a lineup of really, really superb singers. And I know, Nick, that one of the great pleasures of this is that, as is usually the case with the Bell Ensemble, you are talking about a lot of familiar people, singers you have worked with before who have enjoyed collaboration in other projects, and then once in a while a newcomer that comes into the fold. But it gives the Bell Ensemble this wonderful sort of organic energy from project to project. And certainly the cast you've assembled for A Mall and the Night Visitors really represents this nicely, doesn't it?
It does. It's great. The mother, the leading lady, Erin Sura, has sung with the Bell Ensemble, I think, as much as anybody else in the cast, quite a bit over the past few years. Two of the Kings, Cameron Smith and Ryan White, have sung with us also quite a bit in the last year or so. Ryan White for more than that. Aaron Bolden, baritone from Rockford, has performed with the Bell Ensemble in the past, but not for a few years now, and it's really great to invite him back to sing King Balthazar. Lucas Alumbreros is the young man playing Amal, and he's the son of Amy Baudercy and Alejandro Alumbreros, two other local performers. Amy has, both of them have performed with the Bell Ensemble quite a bit, Amy as a soprano and Alejandro as an accompanist. And I'm really excited about Lucas getting the opportunity to perform Amal. I think it suits him rather well. He has just come off of a performance of Oliver earlier this year, which was quite good, I hear. And in the role of Amal, Lucas brings a kind of playfulness and immediacy to the moment that I really think is wonderful, really brings the stage to life.
One of the things that maybe is worth our talking about for a couple minutes is how this is obviously a relatively modern score. I mean, this isn't from the time of Mozart, that's for sure. I mean, this was composed in 1950-51, and one would never mistake it for old music. I mean, it in many respects sounds new and presents all kinds of musical challenges for you and your orchestra and your cast, and yet is also such approachable music, so easy to enjoy, unlike some modern music that can really be kind of a challenge to the listener. Talk for a moment about the challenges and the pleasures that are part of bringing this score to life.
Well, one of the issues for us has been, this isn't exactly what you're asking right now, but one of our biggest challenges was the use of space, and we had to imagined the orchestra being, as it usually in most operatic or musical productions, you have a pit that's in front of the stage, and so the conductor can see not only the orchestra but all of the actors on stage, and for the most part they can see him or her, and that wasn't possible because of the height of our stage. So we had to, in the middle of production rehearsals, we had to switch and move the orchestra behind the stage. So
wow.
So there are lots of moments where this, I mean, this score, which is full of beautiful melodies that are just kind of rolling along and lulling you to sleep or dancing and playing along, will come to an abrupt stop, and it has to begin again. And sometimes that beginning is the singer, and sometimes that beginning is the orchestra.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of points of coordination that are challenging. I think the most enjoyable challenge for me about this this work is to balance all of the many moods that Menotti has imbued. The mother experiencing the deep anguish of poverty and her wish to care for her son. Amal, this young boy, trying to comfort his mother.
Mm.
These kings entering in all their regal pomp into this humble hovel. And then the shepherd music from outside, and kind of weaving all of this together and doing so in a way that really brings it to life, gives it all of the energy and pathos it deserves, but also leaving space for everybody involved, you know, all the singers, all the kings, and the mother and Amal each to have their way of shaping the moment. That has been a wonderful challenge because Menotti has given us so much to work with.
Mm. One of the things that I remember from, when I was a young child, we watched this every Christmas because it would be on NBC year after year after year, right at Christmas, if not right on Christmas Eve. I'm not sure about exactly the day that it would typically air, but I remember watching this year after year, and I think one of the things that made the strongest impression on me was the fact that it was such a vivid depiction of what it means to live in poverty. And I think it made a really strong impression on me to think about a child living in poverty. Hmm. And I think at that point in time, I probably had a vague notion that there are poor people in the world, but that didn't necessarily, in my mind, add up that there are children who are poor and living in places where they are poor and deprived of the things that most of us take for granted. And so on a lot of levels emotionally, this opera really packs a tremendous punch. And I think another thing about it that I really love is the relative simplicity of the story also means that there is a focus to its emotionality that makes it even more powerful and moving. Describe to our listeners what the rehearsal process has been like. And is this something that has had to come together very, very quickly in terms of your singers and your orchestra and so on?
In a lot of ways, yes. Amal has been working on, singers have been working on their own, of course, for months. We began rehearsals with Amal and the mother around a piano in November, and work together through December, just to allow Amal and the mother, mainly to allow them a chance to develop rapport, mm-hmm. you know, and to figure out how they are going to be a mother and a child together, but also to learn the music, of course. Our first, because of the timeline, our first, it is pretty crunched. Our first rehearsal, where we actually had singers on stage moving them around and blocking, was a little over a week ago, I guess, December 30th. And immediately after that first rehearsal, we started including all the chorus members, and I rehearsed with the orchestra once in December and then have met with them several times now in January. It really is a kind of whirlwind as you approach performance dates, but everybody kind of does their thing, you know, does their homework, and then comes to the rehearsal, plugging in what they can contribute, and it works out.
And it seems to me that Amal is a work that seems to inspire the best effort in people, because it's just a piece that means a lot to people, and means a lot for people to be able to be part of it, and so it's the kind of opportunity that the typical musician does not take for granted.
It does. You're right. You're right on with that. And maybe this is a point at which I should share just a little bit about the story itself. It's, as you mentioned, it's a really simple story. And to tell the narrative of what happens is almost boring. I mean, these kings arrive and there's this mother and child and then I can't give away the very last thing that happens, but that's about it. Everything else is just kind of their interplay, but it does center around it. There's pretty intense focus on the poverty of this mother and child, and first of all the contrast. I mean, the contrast is immediate, and then both to the audience and to the mother herself, that these kings are entering, and they are carrying more in their hands, you know, hundreds and thousands of times more value in their hands than she will ever know in her life. Mm-hmm. And the word gold appears at least half a dozen times in the work. And, you know, from the entrance of the kings to a little moment before the kings arrive, when Amal is comforting his mother in her despair over their poverty and his sort of recklessness, but the word gold is repeated in throughout the work in a way that really powerfully, I mean, not like hits you in the head, but it's clear that that's what this is about. This is about these three powerful men who have essentially everything. And then two, a family of two that has nothing. I wanted to make sure to communicate something about the story, because it is short and it's more than just pretty music. It's a beautiful story that people love, and it brings to mind another challenge. I mean, one of the larger challenges in producing this is that it's by so many people so well known, and then by others not at all. Mm. And I grew up familiar with it and knowing lots of people who know it and coming to know it myself. But I have to remind myself that this played on television on NBC for 14 years, and it was a big cultural thing, you know, for people that experienced that or even who lived shortly after that. But for Amal, who was born 3 days ago, that or even half of our chorus members who are current college students, that's just not part of their memory. Amal is something that has to be introduced to them just like, you know, Tannhäuser.
And it's and what a pleasure to be able to encounter it in this way, lovingly presented by the Bell Ensemble. Again, the performance is at the Great Hall of the De Koven Center tonight. And if you would like more information, you can go to the website of the Bell Ensemble, which is Bell, that's B-E-L-L-E, Bell Ensemble Racine, www.bellensemble.org. And there will be a small number of tickets available for purchase at the door as well. But don't let this opportunity go by to encounter this exquisite opera by John Carlo Minotti, Amal and the Night Visitors. Nick Brody, and best wishes to you and your cast, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you, Greg.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. Well, I dare say that just about all of us have heard of the Mutiny on the Bounty, but if you really want to know the story in every last fascinating detail, then the book you need to read is Carolyn Alexander's The Bounty, the true story of the mutiny on the Bounty. Carolyn Alexander is the author of a number of best-selling books, including The Endurance. Perhaps you've read her her work in The New Yorker or Smithsonian or National Geographic. And we are pleased that we can have Carolyn Alexander with us for a few minutes on The Morning Show to talk about her most recent work and the very interesting insights which she yields into the mutiny on the Bounty. Carolyn Alexander, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
Give us some sense, first of all, of how we are able to know as much as we do about the mutiny on the Bounty, which, after all, occurred over 200 years ago. What are the resources available to you and others who want to study this incident and why and how it occurred?
Well, it's amazing how much material is available, and I have to say that the first thing I would say is that the book took me about a year longer than I had planned, because I hadn't anticipated that so much material would have survived from this era. Some sources were very well known right from the get-go. We have William Bligh's Log of the Bounty, which is a running narrative, you know, and in that case, very valuable, because it isn't him looking backwards and shaping events, it's as events unfold on the one hand. We have two manuscript sort of memoirs by two men on the Bounty, one who would be charged with mutiny and one who was loyal to Bligh and was the ship's sailing master. We have an amazing, to me, one of the sort of most curious collections is an album of correspondence that was kept by the sister of one of the men charged with mutiny. And when this man was captured and awaiting trial, she was writing to everybody in the kingdom trying to pull strings to get him off, and she made a copy of every letter she wrote and every letter that was sent back to her and of her correspondence with her brother while he was in the brig, as it were. And so that's the sort of big, some of the big collections. And then one had to sort of keep excavating into all kinds of out-of-the-way sources. I found wills to be an enormously interesting source of information, because sometimes you would learn a great deal just by who somebody left their estate to or mentioned as a legatee. It revealed in about three cases some very curious connections that I would never have imagined that these people had known each other. And so one of the other amazing things, you know, you get in England family collections of correspondence. I remember looking up at one where it was registered, and it says, you know, family correspondence of the Courtenay family from 1100 to 1900. And that's just one family's private, you know, holdings that go back all those centuries. So it's endless if you have the energy.
Speaking of your energy and your time, to what extent did you read previous books about the mutiny, or did you really spend most of your time dealing through these kind of resources that which you just listed?
I had, as a teenager, I had read the famous trilogy by Nordhoff and Hall and was swept away with it. But that work is a work of fiction, so that sort of stayed on one side, though lurking affectionately in my memory. The two sources that, published sources that are generally sort of mined for information, one published in 1831, one a few decades later, I found I sort of came to them with good faith and then very quickly discovered that they were unreliable. And not just unreliable, but in one case, deliberately unreliable. In other words, they turned out to be part of the campaign that was conducted against William Bligh during his lifetime. And so in the case of one of these books, which is used by most historians and researchers at face value, it's published in the 1870s, so it's an old book. You know, you tend to think that it must be close to the source, as it were. It was written by the stepdaughter of one of the mutineers, and every tiny little fact, every trivial little fact, has to be looked at about 10 times over. And so I used that sort of as as evidence of the story being built against Bly, but not, as it turned out, of facts central to what had really happened. And I found that because part of my book comes to be about how the story was manipulated, that to get to the truth, I had to really look only at the kind of pure sources, I would say. Well, obviously, in some cases, when you have memoirs from mutineers or memoirs from the captain, you have to even look at those a little skeptically. But I tried to stick with the first-hand source material and rely as little as I had to on later published accounts.
One interesting choice you make, it might seem relatively inconsequential at first glance, but I think it makes such a difference, is that very early in the book, before we even begin really reading anything, we see a roster of the ship's company, of the Bounty. And you have indicated on this list those that were mutineers, those who were actually loyalists but detained with the other mutineers and so on. And it's interesting because simply at a glance, we realize that not everybody mutinied on the Bounty. And that in itself is, of course, an intriguing part of the story.
Very much so. And not just not everybody mutinied, but when you finally sort of start breaking down what happened, strikingly few were active mutineers. What is so remarkable, and this is where Fletcher Christian grossly miscalculated when he sees the ship, his original plan had been to put Bly and four other individuals with Bly into a small boat and then just leave them. And what he hadn't accounted for is that many men did not wish to stay with mutineers, and whether they personally liked Bly or not was of no consequence, but they, out of loyalty to their duty and their code, if you will, just very matter-of-factly started making their way over the ship to Bly in the boat. And so at that point, Fletcher Christian was looking at almost close to half the ship's company with Bly in the boat, and knowing that there were other men on board who had very vociferously declared their loyalty to Bly but just weren't going to fit in the boat. And so suddenly, you know, you sort of have to think of how Christian felt as he sailed away with his ship half manned, knowing that there were some people on board who, you know, were very disapproving of what he'd done. And it isn't quite the same sort of jolly picture one gets from the movies with him sailing off with a bunch of liberated free men turned mutineer.
The story is much more complex than that. We're speaking with Carolyn Alexander. She is the author of The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Bounty. One of the things you do in telling the story is we're given a very brief introduction to William Bly, and then you take us to Tahiti, 1791, and this is actually after the mutiny has occurred. And we're treated to the arrival in Tahiti of a ship called, I think, the Pandora, which comes to gather up some of these mutineers or some that were associated with them, at least, if not exactly mutineers. I'm just curious about your decision as an author to, in effect, begin your narrative there after the fact.
Well, I had begun to realize at a very early stage of the research that what was going to rivet my attention were the events that happened on land after the mutiny. That was the least examined part of the story, on the one hand, the part that was most likely to yield new material, new characters, but also the part that shapes the story, the popular story that we come to know. The first part of the story, the actual mutiny, sailing to Tahiti, all of that is, there are many details and turns of character that are different from the popular account, but it's recognizably the mutiny on the Bounty, whereas the backside is really a whole other terrain, a whole other story. And so I was trying to think of the way to focus that part where it wouldn't sort of appear like an anticlimax after the mutiny, which is what everybody would be waiting for, as it were. And I wanted to signal that the story was going to be different, and I wanted to focus from the outset on a kind of new set of heroes, if you want, or main characters in the action. And that's the best way, seemed to be, to start with what was going to be their undoing, with what would eventually be the dynamics of a court-martial, and that moment seemed to be that day when the Pandora, the arm of British justice or naval law, looms out of the sea on this beautiful day in Tahiti, and it's all over for all those men who've been living life on this paradise. And I thought that was just the moment of truth.
Hmm. And, of course, one of the things it's a brilliant choice, by the way. Something else is that in just getting these mutineers back to England to face justice, that in and of itself is sort of a multifaceted journal fraught with peril, and not everybody survives. And as a matter of fact, this Captain Edwards, who was he head of the Pandora?
Yes.
He himself faces court-martial because he loses his ship in the voyage. Not only is that interesting in and of itself, but it just reminds us of the enormous peril that faced anyone in that era sailing the seas.
Yes, I thought it was a fascinating chapter, and it's usually the kind, if one is in a historical work, if somebody's treating the Bounty, it's certainly covered, but it's sort of a transitional part towards, you know, a more important part of the story or the sort of winding down of the Bounty, whereas I felt that, again, by showcasing it, as it were, by allowing it to be the first part, you would be able to play out all that amazing detail. And it's a part that we also have a significant amount of source material to allow that kind of detail to be revealed. One of the mutineers who was captured and suffered shipwreck, James Morrison, kept a journal, and his account of what happened, combined with correspondence from one of the other men, is amazing. You know, you get the night cries of the men in the water as the ship goes down, and they're in chains in the hold, and they can't get out. And it's an eyewitness account of a great shipwreck from the age of sail. So even apart from the fact that they're mutineers on the Bounty, I find it riveting.
Right. You mentioned at one point the fact that these sailors, they are charged with mutiny at this point, and they are imprisoned below deck. They can hear what's going on the ship. They are aware of this storm. They can hear the orders being shouted. They know exactly the kind of danger which they are facing.
Yes, and there's, I say in the account, this is, should not have happened. May I hold
yes.
you? I'm going to tell them to stop.
All right. Go ahead.
Yes, all the men who, they were confined in a small and, by their account, airless and very dark box, which had been erected on the ship's quarterdeck for them with just little slats for light and air at the very top, and they were in chains. So confined in this area, as the ship sort of sallied to one side, and they can hear the splashing of the water outside, and they can hear people calling out, one of the things that is very apparent from their own accounts is that because they themselves have so much experience at sea, they understood all the what all the noises meant. You know, when somebody says, get the boats, they know that that means the ship is going to be evacuated. They can hear all the efforts that are being made at the pumps and so forth. And they're trapped, and they can't get out. And there's this more amazing scenes is of these men just shouting and banging with their hands, you know, on the scuttle door, desperate to get out as water starts entering. And indeed, it was only one senses by a kind of series of happenstance that they were actually allowed out. There's a very clear sense that Captain Edward Edwards of Pandora had pretty well placed them as a low priority in terms of, I think he was more concerned with getting his own men out and that these people could go to the devil.
Yes. Let's return to the Bounty. You mentioned some very important facts, important for us to know. One of them being that for the particular voyage that the Bounty undertook, it was surprising to some, disturbing to some, that such a small ship had been chosen. And because it was such a small ship, that meant that Bligh was not going to be a captain, but just a lieutenant. This, in effect, set up some of the circumstances which perhaps helped to make the mutiny possible.
Yes. And what is interesting is that this isn't just sort of historical second guessing where one pours over the equipment of the Bounty and then start seeing deficiencies. These were noted in very clear detail, spelt out before the Bounty sailed. The ship was extremely small, so small that technically speaking, she wasn't rated as a ship. She was not HMS Bounty. She was HMAV Bounty, His Majesty's Armed Vessel Bounty, or known as a transport vessel. And her official rating was as a cutter. And this meant all of this had a kind of protocol that automatically followed, and a cutter did not rate a captain. So, as you said, William Bligh was not promoted to captain, nor even to master and commander, but sailed as a lieutenant. Now, this was certainly not unprecedented, but it was what was unprecedented is that there was no other commissioned officer on board. So Bligh had no peers, as it were. And in a time of crisis, it's useful to be able to look instinctively to the moral authority of your colleagues, as it were. And normally this would have been a first or second lieutenant or somebody else that he could have counted on as being, as it were, of his fraternity. And the other more glaring deficiency, which Bligh comes back to time and again after the fact, is that there were no Marines on board. When Captain Cook, for example, had sailed to the Pacific on all three of his voyages, and he stands as the model to by which to compare the Bounty voyage most closely, he had always carried from 12 to 20 Marines, and these were armed policemen, and their job was not only to sort of defend against any hostilities the ship might face, but also to be there on deck if the captain needed them. So we have a letter from a friend of Bligh's family who visits the Bounty before she sails and then writes a letter to the patron of the Bounty and says, you know, I think that Lieutenant Bligh is being very ill-treated. And he goes on to name these particular defects, in above all, the lack of Marines. And I point out in the book that what is curious is that this same observer had initially wanted his own son to sail on the Bounty, and the ship's muster shows that this man was indeed, you know, mustered on board and was on board while the Bounty was in England being provisioned and getting ready to go. And then as she leaves for the sea, his son disappears, and clearly I think that he just thought, I don't want my son on this voyage.
Hmm. You mentioned the fact that just before they sail, Fletcher Christian meets up with his brother Charles Christian, who himself had just been involved in a mutiny. To what significance do you think that had on what Fletcher Christian went on to do? And do we know that for sure?
Well, it's highly suggestive what goes through Fletcher Christian's head in the hours leading to his own mutiny. certainly, none of this is conclusive. So I certainly draw attention to it, but I try to do so with a light hand. Fletcher Christian's brother had been involved in a different kind of mutiny. The term mutiny was very widely used in the Navy, but it was a direct act of insubordination. In his case, the captain had been trying to flog a seaman, and Fletcher Christian's brother, along with two other officers, had sort of spontaneously leapt in on this man's account. And we know from later evidence that in this particular case, the captain was indeed a tyrant, and justice was accordingly rendered to reflect that. So what you have is Fletcher Christian leaving England, literally with his brother's fate unknown at that stage, not knowing what verdict would be rendered against his brother, but also, I'm sure, with this kind of impassioned account of stepping in, you know, to overthrow, as it were, a tyrannical captain, ringing in his ears. Now, one thing that is curious is that we have the exact language that was reported to have been used by both the captain of this other mutiny and also of the men who leapt in to help the oppressed seamen, as it were. And I do find curious echoes in Fletcher Christian's language on the hours leading up to his mutiny. He says, you know, that if Bligh were to flog him, to bend him, to break him, that he would take Bligh into his arms and jump into the sea and sort of be the death of both of them. And this is such an extraordinarily weird thing to say when there is no indication whatsoever or of any possibility that Bly would flog Fletcher Christian, not from any hint of from any party. But this is happens to be the language that was used by his brother of his account, and one wonders if Christian, Fletcher Christian, isn't sort of working himself up into a kind of lather about a similar, you know, imagining a similar situation. So I leave it as speculative. I sort of reintroduce it at the moment when we're trying to enter what's going on in Fletcher Christian's head. But I certainly, you're correct to say that this is inconclusive, just highly suggestive. What is conclusive is that the Christian brothers, Charles Christian, even Edward Christian, were somewhat eccentric and high-strung, and Charles Christian, the other mutineer, if you will, had a breakdown after his event and never, ever recovered. And so one wonders if this strain, if you will, of high-strung weakness was something that ran in the family, and that's sort of worth putting out on the table.
As you describe the story from mutiny on, and then, of course, the aftermath as most of the mutineers are brought to justice, we are left with a sense that the question that comes to many of us of who was right and who was wrong and how right were the rights, how wrong were the wrongs, that's a very difficult thing to untangle from this point in time.
Well, I think that what was categorically wrong and had to be regarded as wrong by all parties in its day, ultimately, was the seizure of the ship and the attempt to kill Bly and his companions by putting them in a small boat. Even Fletcher Christian's brother sort of writes and says, well, you know, by no means could this be excused, but, and then he tries to put it in a context that makes his brother at least sympathetic. But I think the crime of mutiny was unjustifiable, and certainly unjustifiable in these circumstances. What remains hazy is exactly why it happened. And the one element that was necessary for the mutiny to happen was Fletcher Christian. In other words, if you removed him as a figure from the Bounty and you looked at any other altercation Bly might have had with his other men, with the carpenter, a mutiny would never have happened. It wasn't as if this was a situation brewing disaster. It was a situation in which, when you looked at it, you could see that certain elements that were inherent in the Bounty's voyage and ship's complement, when the moment of crisis came, aided Christian affect that crisis. But he is the troubled element. If he were removed, the Bounty would have carried on like any other British ship, with undoubtedly all sorts of complaints being made on both sides by captain and men, as was the custom, and have arrived in England, and everybody would have gone off and told tales of their amazing adventure to the South Pacific, and that would have been the end of it.
Without a mutiny.
It's Fletcher Christian who cracks. And why exactly he cracked is hard to fathom. I try to suggest, you know, there's all kinds of suggestive possibilities, but obviously the key document that we're missing is Fletcher Christian's diary, and alas, that's never going to surface.
The book is The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Bounty, published by Viking. Carolyn Alexander, the author. Carolyn Alexander, my congratulations to you on an utterly fascinating book, and I thank you so much for joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much.
Monday on The Morning Show, a conversation with a woman named Fern Pessin, who has written a book called I'll Be Right There, A Guide for Adults Caring for Aging Parents. On Tuesday, Dr. Art Sear will pay his monthly visit to the program to offer his thoughts on current events, including, of course, the situation between the United States and Iran. On Wednesday, we'll hear from Nate Stamper, the director of the Racine Theater Guild's current production of On Golden Pond, which opens this weekend. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter.